Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Book Spider podcast. This is a Book of the Week format podcast where we do our best to offer the most rigorous analytical perspectives we can, even at the risk of being quite dull, and we promise never to have a segment about what beer to pair with the novel. This week we're doing something a little unusual, which is that we're coming back to an author that we've covered relatively recently. A few months ago we did an episode on Dana Spiotta's second novel, Eat the Document, which was about countercultural radicalism in the 60s and its evolution and fallout in the late 90s. And when we read Eat the Document, we made the point that many of the qualities she was observing in late 90s activism, for better or worse, are not characteristic of contemporary activism. And in some ways, it seems to me that this novel actually kind of functions as a spiritual sequel to Eat the Document, even though none of the characters overlap, given that, you know, it is partly a dissection of resistance culture in the early Trump administration. So a quick synopsis, and we don't always give this warning because sometimes it matters more than others, but I would say, you know, if you're planning on reading Wayward and you haven't yet, really do stop listening, go read it, come back to the podcast when you've read it. I think all of us had somewhat mixed feelings about it, but it's certainly an interesting and compelling novel. And, you know, if you're interested in it, I would say definitely go read it. So anyway, our brief synopsis here, just as a refresh for anyone who might not have been through it recently. The protagonist is Sam Raymond, who's a 53-year-old woman who on impulse decides to leave her husband, move out of the suburbs, buy a decrepit house in an underprivileged part of Syracuse, New York. And around the time that she makes that decision, Sam also becomes involved in various online groups, falling roughly into what was termed at the time the resistance, although she's involved in little or no meaningful political action through those groups. Our other viewpoint character, and we trade off between the two throughout the novel, our other viewpoint character is Allie, Sam's daughter, who is near the end of her junior year of high school, and she's having a sexual and romantic affair with a 29-year-old real estate developer, Joe. And Joe is wealthy and attractive, and Sam initially finds him alluring, finds their affair exciting and empowering, but gradually comes to realize that his politics and aesthetics are vapid and selfish and philistinic. And Sam, who has suffered from insomnia throughout the novel, goes for a walk at 3 a.m., sees an unarmed teenager shot dead by an inexperienced rookie police officer. And when she sees how that incident is being described by the newspaper, she files a complaint with the Citizens Review Board and attempts to contact a reporter to share her side of the story. Now, Sam and Allie have been estranged since Sam decided to move out, and that estrangement deepens when Allie sees Sam make a very unsuccessful attempt at confrontational stand-up comedy, which makes light of a difficult incident where Child Protective Services were called on Sam and her husband, following an incident where Allie passed out from exhaustion after studying all night for a test. Now, Sam is meeting a friend at the state fair to discuss her work to publicize the truth of what happened in the police shooting. She sees Allie and Joe together, including a brief kiss. We later see the same scene from Allie's perspective and discover that Allie wanted her mother to see them kissing. And at her house, Sam has an incident in which she believes she's being attacked. She has the sensation of being hit on the head and lying in a pool of her own blood. She's barely able to call 911 before she passes out. We have a brief interpolation then of the diaries of Clara Loomis, a fictional woman from the early 20th century who at 17 joins what's basically a communitarian sex cult, then realizes falling in love with a... then realizes, I'm going to have to equalize that. I laughed a little too hard there. Then realizes she's falling in love with a particular individual within that cult, which is, of course, against the rules of the communitarian sex cult. At the end of the Clara Loomis diaries, Sam wakes in her hospital room where she's told that she passed out from a transient ischemic attack, likely brought on by stress and lack of sleep, and she and Allie reconcile. And Allie, by this point, has had essentially a mutual breakup with Joe, though, you know, he kind of initiates it, but it's clear that she's not too sad to see him go away. So, I guess my first question is, I think this is a very thematic novel, right? It's thematic with like a capital T, right? It's very interested in kind of issues of present concern, right? And the first thing I thought was interesting was how it deals with the concept of gentrification, right? So Sam is in some sense a gentrifier. I mean, she's moving into this poor, rough urban neighborhood and, you know, raising the property value of a cheap house, right? And she is called out as a gentrifier. I mean, that word is explicitly used in relationship to her by one of the other characters. And of course, that's, you know, generally framed in current discourse as a villainous role. But then, you know, she also takes this, she's in this position where she can at least try to take this action against, you know, violent racist policing, right? So my question is Sam helping or harming the community that she's moved to? And can Sam's role in the novel be generalized, or should it be generalized into a broader statement by the novel about the idea of gentrification?
I'm going to say that I don't think she's actually a gentrifier. Like I get that, you know, she is a reasonably wealthy white woman moving into a urban neighborhood. But I don't know. Like, it seems to me like acts of gentrification that matter are on a much grander scale. So, for example, the city of Cincinnati recently built a Major League Soccer stadium in the West End neighborhood, which is between downtown and State Route 75. And I live on the west side of 75 in Price Hill, Delhi area. But, you know, regardless. So the West End up to this point is a poor, mostly black neighborhood. And the city of Cincinnati decides to displace a bunch of people to build the stadium and increase rent prices once the stadium is there, displacing further people who can't now can't afford to live in the gentrified West End. So when we're talking about gentrification, I feel like it for it to actually matter, you know, it needs to be happening on a larger scale. Now, obviously, if Sam goes in there and, like, tries to be a hoity-toity white person in a black neighborhood and is acting like a dick, okay, maybe. But I don't think that a white woman having a midlife crisis and deciding to move out and to move into the city, to be a part of the city, is necessarily gentrification in the like really problematic way that we think of it.
So if she's accused of being a gentrifier by other characters in the novel, do you think, is that a critique of the way that certain kind of simplistic labels are thrown around too easily, or is it just a are maybe like the whole idea is a red herring a little bit?
Maybe it's a red herring. Maybe it's a way of like complicating the way we look at Sam. Like, I don't think what she does is extremely problematic. Like, it's not like she displaced anyone, really.
The house was vacant.
Right, the house was vacant. It's not like she's beating out a poorer family who could have afforded it if she had, you know, not made a better offer or something like that. She's not doing that. So maybe it is just, I don't know if it's a red herring, but like, yeah, if someone calls her a gentrifier, than we think about it, right? We think about what she's doing, and so it to me, it's probably more of just the technique of the novel getting us to think about the issue rather than the novel actually saying she is a gentrifier.
Yeah, I think, is it MH who... I know.
I believe it's
MH calls
yeah.
her a gentrifier. Yeah, and
MH
yeah is something else. Like
right.
She's, you know, everything that comes out of her mouth is you know has got a lot of spin on it. So, you know, I think I'm with Patrick on this because Sam doesn't have goals. Like she doesn't like know why she's there really. She's not, and I think that you can. It would be too simple to basically say like gentrification comes with some sort of like nefarious goal, but Sam is not fixing the place up, you know, in order to like make it, you know, more valuable to sell later or something like that. Like it's just a kind of it's an impulse. And it may be interesting to think about like what a rich white lady, like the kind of latitude a person like Sam has with her impulses, you know, she has the freedom to do this kind of like impulsive thing that, you know, maybe a lot of people wouldn't be able to afford to do, you know, not very many people can just sort of buy a house, because they're having a bad, you know, year where they just learn that their mother is dying. It's kind of weird, but it's not, as Patrick said, I think gentrification is not something that is measured in intent. It's measured in, you know, like the effect that it has on the neighborhood. And I don't think she seems to be having that effect on the neighborhood, really.
I really don't want to go down the rabbit hole of arguing about the idea of gentrification. And I think it's probably like a cultural buzzword that's overused a little bit in places that maybe it's not actually effective as an analytical tool. Which is, you know, kind of on some level, the first time I went through this was my reading of kind of, to the extent that Spiotta is trying to make a point here, I sensed some sympathy in that point. But for the time being, I have some thoughts about how to kind of tie some of these things, some of this together with some other things in the novel. But for the time being, we might move then to my next question, which was about Allie's affair with Joe, right? And the interesting thing to me about Allie's affair with Joe was that it seems to be building to a crisis which doesn't really occur, right? You know, she realizes she's full of shit. She realizes she doesn't respect him. He realizes that she's beginning to ask more from the relationship than he's comfortable offering. And those are actually, you know, leaving aside the kind of legal context for what they're doing, those things are like normal reasons for many relationships ending, right? And it really seems, if I'm not mistaken, like Allie's going to be fine. Other, you know, there's a passing suggestion that maybe it wasn't wise for her to send him quite so many nude pictures, but, you know, that's not really, that's kind of there as a lingering question, but it's not really developed into anything. So do you agree that the plot line of their affair seems to resolve with minimal conflict and trauma? And if so, what do we make of that thematically?
I agree that it does seem to resolve with minimal conflict and trauma. And my take on it is it makes me wonder if Allie is... She strikes me as unbelievably mature for a 17-year-old.
When you say unbelievably, you mean implausibly from a craft perspective?
Right, implausibly from a craft perspective. This is kind of like the, as far as I understand, like this is Allie's first relationship of any kind of depth. If I'm remembering correctly, you know, this is her like loss of virginity relationship. Is that right?
That's my understanding. Yeah.
And so, no, I don't think that the relationship should resolve this easily. Like, the no 17-year-old girl slash no 17-year-old young woman is going to, you know, get out of a relationship in which she lost her virginity this way. I don't think that it would, this is the way it would really, like, go down, at least not 90% of the time. And that's what I think I mean when I say she's implausibly mature from a craft standpoint. Like, sure, maybe if she were 25, you know, and kind of like is at first interested in a guy, and like it's, you know, the beginning of the relationship is exciting and new and hot and heavy, but then she discovers that she doesn't really like him personally. Sure, I could see that fading away, but for a 17-year-old, I don't see that as much.
I don't know if she's implausibly, I don't know. I don't know how to ascribe necessarily, like, what, you know, I know that not only that I was an especially immature, like, teenager and
you were
early 20, I think of myself as one.
I think I probably was too.
Yeah, and I did have people in my circle who I, like, just seemed like adults. I don't know. I think it might be too easy to necessarily, like, inscribe parameters around, like, what someone can be at any given age. Like, it's pretty, it's pretty flexible. I think that, like there might be no essential, like, maybe no essential borders. But maybe, like, as you say, that it is, like, at least really, like, it's very distinctive. Like her maturity is super distinctive. And to me, thematically, that is just in relative to her mom. Like, her mom is a 50-year-old woman whose mother is basically keeping, like, details about her own, like, diagnosis secret for weeks to basically protect Sam from Sam, I realize I'm saying mother a lot. That's kind of potentially confusing. Allie's mom, Sam, is a fragile person, or sensitive. Fragile is not the right way of putting it. Very sensitive. And Allie is not. Like, that's I think, like craft wise, something that, like, Spiata is kind of doing here a little bit. And I don't know necessarily if that makes Allie, like, unrealistic or not. I think that it does make her a little bit definitely improbable. Her thoughts, you know, it isn't just how she acts with Joe, how she thinks, how she behaves in general is at a kind of higher level, and that feels interesting with Sam there, who I kind of think is, I kind of read her as just not as in control of her own feelings, I guess. I didn't necessarily read. I think that, like, craft-wise, for Joe, for the split at the end to be, you know, to be more momentous, the novel has to, like the silhouette of the novel has to change so much. I think, like, that, like, and so I don't know if just Spiata was not really interested in telling that story and was like, well, I got to get rid of Joe, and this is, you know, this is the most convenient way, because I don't know, I didn't ascribe too much thematic intent there, really. I don't know.
I'd been trying to build up to this point, but I might just put it out now. the best system that I can make thematically for what the novel's doing, and this is something I believed in more the first time I read it. The second time through, it seemed maybe a little bit more scattered, less focused on this. But like, the system that I was making the first time I read the novel was that all these characters and plot lines are about, like, they're all about the kind of the individual versus the general, right? Meaning, like, they're all about these kind of ideas or archetypes that you expect to go one way, and then the particulars of the individual prove the other way, right? So, like, and, like, Sam, going back to the idea of gentrification, right? Sam is a clueless, privileged white lady who buys a house in the city, but then actually tries in a legitimate way to be a responsible member of that community, right? In ways which are above what you would expect based on her kind of general level of flightiness and lack of focus, right? So, you know, there's kind of the archetype of the white middle class gentrifier, and then the way that she behaves in practice goes the opposite, right? And Allie and Joe, you have this kind of archetypal story of, like, immature teenager being manipulated by a scumbag, but in practice the reality of their individual characters are such that she happens to be able to handle that. I mentioned Clara Loomis, right? Like, there's a couple scenes in the first half of the novel where this historical figure of Clara Loomis is being kind of reduced to these one-dimensional kind of historical villain archetypes, right? As a racist or a eugenicist or someone who's like in a sex cult in ways which suggest that it's sinister of her or bad of her character to participate in that. But then we see the world through her perspective and she becomes a much more sympathetic character, right? So my first time through this, my sense was that structurally it's about, again, like the way that the particulars complicate stories that we think, or people or characters that we think fit into these molds. It reminded me almost a bit of, honestly, not nearly as ambitiously or complicatedly done, but like if you read Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, right, there's this pattern where you meet a character and they seem like this horrifying grotesque and they seem very unsympathetic, and then 100 pages later, they've turned into this very textured human, right? And it's lovely the way that Dickens does it. I'm honestly not a huge Dickens fan, but like that, I remember reading Great Expectations and really being moved by his way of turning these kind of grotesque archetypes into these eventually sympathetic characters. And there's, I wonder if there's not some version of that that Spiotta's trying to do here in a contemporary setting.
I can see that. I just don't. I guess, like, where do you go from there? Like, is it interesting that she's doing that to modern, like, types of people? Like, she's doing this to the kind of, To I guess modern types, modern categorizations of people, the trope or modern tropes, the trope of the young, like, 17-year-old who's seduced and kind of controlled by a nearly 30-year-old man who's, you know, I guess I get it, but I don't know if I'm buying it all the way.
Are you not buying it? Are you not buying it as my interpretive framework, or are you not buying it as Spiotta actually carrying that technique out?
I like your interpretive framework. Even if I apply it to Wayward, I don't know exactly. It is inherently interesting to take a character. Compelling and engaging and fun to read something that, you know, the pirate turns out to be a good dad, you know, or something, but like that shit's been done forever. So like, why is that interesting now?
Yeah. And that kind of ties back in with like one thing that I think we all observed about this was that there's a lot of anticlimax and irresolution here, right? Like Sam and her husband kind of seem like maybe they're reconciling as a couple, but we don't really know what's going to come of it, right? Or like there's the police shooting that Sam is making some effort to, you know, expose the reality of. It's never really clear what will happen with that. Allie's affair with Joe fizzles, and we don't really know what the long-term consequences will be of that, right? There's like this culminating act of violence at the end of the novel that turns out to be a fainting spell, and we don't really know what that. I mean, it's a climax that's actually not a climax, right? It's an assault that turns out to be, oh, she just got too stressed and fainted. And I mean, to the question of like, you made the point of like, what do you do with it? What do you do with the technique? If you think of it as being about complicating the general with the particular, maybe part of the reason that you don't feel like more is done with that is because there's not really much, like the stories all kind of end midway through, right? And if they were carried out to their logical, if they were carried out to their implied endings or their suggested endings, maybe it would be clearer what was being done with the kinds of like misdirection that we're talking about here, right? I don't know. I mean, what did you guys make of the kind of anticlimax and irresolution of the core plot threads? Did that seem purposeful? Did you have any sense of what the purpose of that was?
If so, earlier, Chris, you used the word, like, you don't know if Allie's maturity is unrealistic, though you do think it's improbable. And so let's say that improbable is a better word, and that's the reason that, like, I'm having the reaction I am to the way Joe and Allie's story fizzles out. I would say that maybe I don't know. I was trying to think of a way to connect this to your question, Hans, and I feel like I'm not doing it. So I'm just going to say that I didn't like the way that Joe and Allie's relationship fizzles out, and I probably don't like the way that, you know, the attack on Sam turns out to be a fainting spell, and yeah. So I was not super happy with the way things end in the middle of things, and I'm not sure what that would have to do with your framework that you're talking about, which I think is a good framework. Like, I think it holds true for most of the characters. The only one I would say that it doesn't hold true for is probably Joe, who, like, when we learn the particulars about him, my reaction is that he is still a scumbag.
Right. Yeah, and I think he is probably. I don't think there's any attempt made for him to be a non-scumbag, right? I think it's more about Allie's resoluteness resoluteness is the wrong word. Like, that thread, I think, is more notable in that framework because she is, in fact, not traumatized by it. And if anything, probably it's ultimately beneficial for her to become more experienced at kind of critiquing these powerful figures, right? Like, there's some wisdom she's gotten from this affair.
So I don't know. I do find it dissatisfying, but I don't know from a craft perspective whether that it's the correct decision or not.
You guys keep saying unrealistic, and it like, or I think Patrick has said unrealistic.
I said unrealistic,
then, you know,
but then I agreed that maybe the better word is improbable, which I do like.
And I'm not, just to be clear, I don't know if I think that any of this is unrealistic or improbable, right? I'm going to plead agnosticism in regards to the emotional maturity of 17-year-old girls.
Okay. Probably, yeah, let's do the smart stuff here and say we just don't know.
I will say that my experience from being 17 and dating 17-year-old girls is they can, in fact, be very into you one day and completely not give a shit about you the next. I certainly found that possible.
So, but I was going to connect it to, I think, something that you did say, Hans, which is, I don't know if you said ending in the middle of things, but ending without a kind of a resolution. I actually kind of think those are kind of connected, and maybe they're sort of connected to a sort of central difficulty that we're having talking about this. I actually think this book is trying to be like, what is the term? Like slice of life realism in that mold where there's no kind of sort of dramatic arc that is like inherently, you know, like part of like storytelling, like traditional storytelling where like, you know, there is some kind of resolution at the end that kind of ties off something that has, you know, built up over the course of the story. This, you know, I think that probably unhealthy relationships like Allie and Joe's, which is, you know, however you want to categorize it, like it's, you know, unhealthy. They end like this all the time. Like this is not like those types of relationships happen all the time, whether we like approve of them or not. And probably more often than not, they end without like some like really terrible like thing happening that, you know. And so I think that like the story feels like it's trying to, and then like Sam too, you know, Sam, you know, the story would be that Sam would be, you know, getting some retaliatory like attack, you know, because she reported what she saw, and you know, the police hired somebody who had, you know, like attacked her. You know, that would be the story. That would be like the reality is that, you know, she's a stressed out person who's really lost, and like, you know, reports of police misconduct happen all the time, and you know, they don't necessarily amount to anything. They certainly don't usually amount to the police retaliating. So like, I don't know, this actually felt like almost like it was trying to be real. I don't want to use the word realism necessarily, but it was almost trying to veer away from some of the tools and features of a sort of like a traditional story where we would look for a like culminating events or like you know, like Allie and Joe's story amounting to what, you know, the story version of Allie and Joe's romance, where that would end. It just ends in a kind of more, you know, a nothing burger way, and that's kind of how a lot of shit ends. I don't know, does that make sense to you guys? That's kind of how I read this. And
well, and that would make sense. I mean, in kind of the context of if part of the idea is that, again, the particulars of these things frustrate or complicate the kind of narrative versions we have of them, right? If Sam kind of betrays the idea that we have of, you know, rich white ladies being oblivious, or if Clara Loomis kind of betrays the idea that we have of racist eugenicists in the early 1900s, then part of kind of complicating that narrative would in fact be for our expected climaxes to turn into irresolution, right? To have these stories pan out in the exciting story ways would buy into the kind of mythical versions of them that are already being disregarded and kind of avoided, right?
Damn.
So it makes sense to me that, I guess the irresolution makes sense in that way, right?
Shit.
It does seem to me generally like if, you know, when you have a novel where the plot ends in irresolution, that's almost always, that's like one of your big signs that this is like a theme novel, right? Not ha-ha is the wrong word, but like, okay, reader, you've been wanting one thing, but I'm now making it really clear that you should have been reading for theme instead of plot, right? I don't know, like, this is maybe kind of a, again, sort of a, the scale is very different here, right? But like Infinite Jest, right? Like Infinite Jest famously spends 1,000 pages setting up a climax, which then is left unresolved. And the reason it does that is because it's not there to really be a novel about build up resolution, three act story, right? It's there to be a novel that makes a bunch of statements about the nature of entertainment. And if you are reading it for the climactic action, you are reading the wrong novel or reading it in the wrong way, right? And there's a version of that, I think, here where if you're reading it for the kind of climactic blow up, you're reading the wrong novel, or you're reading this novel in a way that you should already have been trained not to expect from it. So you mentioned slice of life, Chris, and I mean, like I've said, I think that one of the things that's to some extent gestured toward here, right, is kind of a chronicle of the texture of life in kind of like insulated white left circles during the early Trump administration. And there's a certain amount here of satire of internet discourse, right? There are like interpolated Facebook posts. There's text messaging. One thing that you hear about sometimes is that a lot of novelists in kind of like part of being a contemporary novelist now is having to kind of struggle with the question of how am I going to include social media and texting in ways which seem authentic and readable while still having a literary quality, because, you know, they're forms of writing that tend to have not much aesthetic merit, right? So craft-wise, how well do you think Spiotta does with the interpolation of social media and texting?
I think it was a mixed bag. I have a quote. Page 190 in my Kindle copy. What happened? What did she do? Sam said. There's a petition on Medium, Lacey said. Sam's phone pinged. I just airdropped you the link, said Tuck. I don't know why, but I read that and I just, I don't know, like maybe it's perfectly capturing how a generation that isn't like native to so maybe it's good. I don't know. I when I read it, it was so jarring because I felt like these are being inserted into conversation. And now I'm thinking about it. Maybe they feel like they're being inserted into conversation because these are all women of a generation that is somewhat outside of the digital, like age, or digital. They're not digital natives. So maybe they're inserting it. Maybe they're trying to like impress each other with their own, you know, why the hell would you airdrop a link?
That makes a lot of sense to me, actually, right? Like, it's very characteristic of people that age. It's very characteristic of people that age to overcomplicate a simple process, right? Like, my dad recorded a song about 6 months ago and was just like systematically incapable of letting me hear that song over the internet, right? And it's like there are so many ways to get someone a recording of a song using the internet that like it was difficult for me even kind of to like start with directions, right? Because like there's 1,000 different ways, you know? But it's very characteristic of people that age to like overcomplicate a very simple thing like sending a link to a Medium petition. I actually found that kind of, now that you dwell on that detail, I don't know if I thought about it at the time, but it actually feels very authentic and kind of endearing to me.
Yeah, I'm going to walk it back because I read that and I was like, what the hell, Dana? Like, what are you doing? This is you inserting these words here and not knowing what they mean. But now that was unfair of me. I think that that's pretty obviously got to be what she's doing. Like, this is women in their 50s and 60s trying to use cell phones. And that is endearing. So maybe she's, I have to admit, like, when I kind of reached that in my read, I was sort of, I don't know, like, it kind of colored my whole, like, retroactively at that point in time. I'll have to think about the book to really answer that question, Hans, because maybe I should rethink other parts that I was sort of like wondering exactly why we were getting all of these details about, you know, Facebook or, you know, the Facebook groups, you know, Sam navigating them. And it might be because it was trying to reflect that lack of like intuitive comfort with those tools.
Yeah, there was something that felt very authentic about there's all those weird Facebook groups at the beginning, right? And there's and the kind of sample posts from them. And there's something that felt very authentic about it. Like, it felt very like a very lightly fictionalized version of something that she'd actually encountered in 2017. I think it's very hard. I don't know, like, it's tough with that kind of discourse, because it's almost impossible to satirize it, right? Like, normally you would take something like that and push it to its most kind of absurd end for comic effect, but it's like, it's already pushed itself to its most absurd end for comic effect. So you can't do that, right? And it's probably good that she doesn't do any more of that than she does. Like, it feels authentic as a way of establishing kind of a mode of talking and thinking in that time and place, but any more of it would have been very quickly insufferable, because there's not much you can do really other than just kind of present it and say this exists. You can't really fuck with it because it's already fucking so hard with itself, you know?
Yeah, I'm looking at a note, a kind of another spot early in the Facebook group tour in the novel, and she's kind of following along. She's kind of a lurker, Sam, and she's following along between following another post thread where another woman, divorced in 55. She says in the post, is trying to lose a lot of weight and trying to get rid of, like, trying to look different, basically. And that sort of runs counter to the values of the group. And, you know, one of the other women in the group says, if what you want to look like coincides with what the culture says you should look like, you might want to interrogate it. And I couldn't tell, like, whether Spiata was making fun of this, or if that's, like, I guess I found myself in a similar trap that Patrick was describing with Allie. Like, it didn't feel real to me. It felt like kind of like making fun or like satirizing this. It didn't feel like an actual person, but I don't know. Maybe that, it, you know, kind of going back to like the broad, just like nakedly, explicitly, ideological ways in which people were like attacking each other in 2017 on Facebook specifically. Maybe that's also unfair of me, and maybe I should, I don't know. I think maybe she did a really good job, actually.
I mean, the thing about the internet is essentially any ridiculous conversation that you can imagine does in fact exist, right?
It has happened, yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's all realistic.
I was just going to say that this conversation has definitely made me rethink some of my conclusions about the book. And as much as I kind of hate it when authors not necessarily leave things not resolved, but when they have like some BS pedantic message about like the nature of fiction itself, as much as I tend to dislike that, like the way we've all discussed this novel makes me feel like it's, I mean, I thought it was pretty well put together when I read it, but like, it's definitely put together in ways that I hadn't even considered. And I think it's definitely pretty good on, you know, a craft level, 100%.
It's definitely, you know, we all went through, for any listeners who don't know it, we all went through the same MFA program. And one of our professors there would talk about how, like, there's a certain habit that you see where, you know, when you're teaching like a freshman writing workshop, somebody brings in a story where a bunch of shit just happens and it doesn't add up to anything or it doesn't mean anything. And when you say, well, nothing happens here and it just kind of, you know, doesn't add up or mean anything, they're like, yeah, man, that's how life is. So, you know, I think if you wanted to be unkind to this book, it's kind of like that idea writ large. But I think it's doing it in a thoughtful and textured enough way that it's not just a bunch of shit that
right,
doesn't mean anything.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like my gut reaction is that kind of story is bullshit, but I'm rescinding that gut reaction in relation to this book. Like, I'm glad it's not 1,000 pages like Infinite Jest, you know, like I think I would be more justified in being pissed off with Infinite Jest, you know, if I've never read it, but like you've mentioned this before that it like comes to this, like it doesn't fulfill the climax that it has been promising. And I can't imagine taking kindly to that after 1,000 pages, but you know, after, you know, I forget how long the audiobook was, but, you know.
All right. Well, that seems like a pretty good conclusion, actually. It's a little bit shorter than some of our episodes, but, you know, I mean, I think we kind of had some interesting thoughts about what's happening from a structural and thematic standpoint and how those two things kind of feed into each other. And I admire this book a lot, and I admire kind of the points that you guys, that we've all kind of been making about what it's doing. I'm quite fond of Spiotta's work in general. And I think like having read other things that she's done, I was aware that like she definitely can do the kind of the more classically structured resolution here. So she can do some of those things that she's kind of choosing not to here. And I mean, I'm somewhat positively disposed toward it, I think, partly just from generally being a fan of her work. And yeah, so good conversation, guys. I really appreciate it. Is it Patrick's turn?
Yeah, it's my turn.
Another Dana Spiotta novel.
What? No, I mean, I do like Dana Spiotta. Like, her perspective, like, she... I think she's only a few months older than I am. Like, I think so. Like, I really feel like her perspective is very similar to mine. So I definitely like get her perspective, and I like what she's doing. But I'm not gonna pick a Dana Spiotta book.
And for what it's worth, the two novels that she wrote in between this and Eat the Document are much less overtly political. They're much more kind of about like small scale human stories that aren't necessarily tied to particular kind of political moments in the way that Eat the Document and Wayward are. No, sorry to interrupt your choice there.
And before you, Patrick, where do you come down on Wayward?
I think I like to Eat the Document a little bit more, but I like this. Like, you know, the way I talked about it was kind of critical, but it doesn't really reflect my experience, which I thought this was solid. Like, I was listening to it, like, thoroughly interested almost the whole time. I did find the ending where it all just kind of stops a little weird. But the way you guys have talked about it, like, it kind of enlightens me as to why it needs to end that way. And again, as much as I don't really like that and tend to think that fiction that talks about the nature of fiction is like not that, like, that's not really my bag. Either way, you know, yeah, this is super solid. Thought it was great. Really good.
How about you, Chris? If this book were a person, would you want to go have a beer with it?
I think if this book were a person, we would be unlucky to remind each other of someone else just by chance that each of us didn't like. And we would just be like, maybe they're a good person, but I don't want to see them anymore. I think that's a poor way of saying, I think I read this novel wrong. And I'm only realizing it now and talking about it. So I'm glad I was helpful for you, Patrick. I think that I was helpful for me in just realizing that if I want to read it again, if I want to kind of have a different relationship with the book, I need to read it again and try to appreciate it as on its own merits. I probably won't. I do admire it, but I probably won't reread it.
Whereas I might even seek out more Dana Spiata books. Like, just...
I'll definitely do that.
So, I'm not certain that this pick is... like, what connection there is between this pick and Wayward. I think that we could make plenty of some connections between this and Split Tooth by Tanya Tagaq. So I'll probably be asking about that. I'll probably mention that. But if any similarities strike me between Wayward and my pick, I'll also, kind of link those up as well. So I'm picking Kane by Jean Toomer, which is a hybrid work of poetry, short stories, and like the final part is a 70-page novella. And it's about, like, you know, Black experience in the South.
All right, very good. Well, thanks much for your time, guys. I hope you have a good afternoon.
Peace out.
Hope you have a great afternoon,
guys.
Peace
out, listeners.
Bye.